Well, thank you. Very kind. And pleased to be here. It's always a mixed blessing being the a featured session because you get to get the honor of being called out in the program, but you also have the honor of speaking to the largest number of empty chairs. And so these chairs will go away much smarter, perhaps, about the world of immunization. Chris asked me to look a little bit ahead in terms of what our last year could mean going forward on the immunization communications front, and I've tried to do that with this presentation today. I do that knowing, as we often have told people throughout the last number of years, when people ask us to make predictions about flu seasons and where it's going and how it's going to play out, that the only thing predictable about flu and the only thing predictable of flu pandemics is how unpredictable they are. So that's my disclaimer. I don't guarantee that my predictions or my forecast will turn out. We do deal with a lot of unpredictability and uncertainty. I thought it would be helpful in terms of looking forward to first kind of take a step back and look backwards and look at some of the things that we did as part of the H1N1 response and to use them as the framework for some of the look forward. And so if you look back, there were a number of key elements in terms of our communication strategy and our approach. And many of these probably weren't obvious. They weren't meant to be obvious, but these were taking you behind the screen and some of the things that we do in terms of communications and media at CDC. One, we try to have a strong foundation for our messages and our communications, and there are probably three key pillars of that. Risk communications principles and practices, formative or audience research, talking to people, learning how they perceive the world, how they talk about things, their language, their concerns, their interests. We also spend a lot of time trying to make sure that we use some of the best practices that we have learned and developed over the many years in the world of immunization communications. And so those provide the foundation, and I'll go into a little bit more depth in a minute about those. H1N1 required obviously a very swift and strong and comprehensive media relations plan, and we had that. We also had multiple communications channels, so it may have just seemed that Dr. Shuchat was on the news, but she was in other places, and we had many elements of our communications besides the news media. As many of you know, because you probably were our partners, we rely on extensive communications and collaboration and coordination with a lot of different organizations. It doesn't work unless we're linked and we can make things mushroom in multiple places. And then at the beginning and throughout, we try to be guided by data and research and information and make adjustments along the way based on that. In terms of our foundation, what were some of the core concepts that guided us in terms of H1N1? Well, one, as was alluded to in today's plenary session, was telling people what you know when you know it. But I think there are two important additional items to be considered there. One is that you need to put that information into context. It's not just simply a matter of FYI-ing the American public or telling the media, I think you ought to know this. Because when you tell the media, I think you ought to know this, to them, they interpret that as, this must be really important, now tell me why. And so the other part of this is making sure that when you tell people information, that you also tell them what to do as a result of that information. And those are both key tenets, along with telling people what you know when you know it. We try to have an audience perspective first and foremost. We know we're a scientific organization. We know that there's a lot of scientific colleagues talking to scientific colleagues, public health people talking to public health people. But if we want our messages to be appropriately conveyed through the media and we want the public to understand our recommendations, to adopt our recommendations, we really have to speak in words and language that they understand and look at the world from their perspective. Another core component of our foundation is acknowledging uncertainty. And again, it's not just a matter of acknowledging uncertainty, it's going another additional step and telling people what it means or what it could mean. And one of the things that you saw, I think, a lot, or I hope you noticed a lot in terms of H1N1, is that we often told people that things could change quickly and unpredictably. Another key tenet is sharing dilemmas and also foreshadowing possibilities, letting people know that things could change and some of the ways that they might change so that they're not surprised when those changes take place. Early on, we used this, we told people in our press conferences that our recommendations are interim. They could change quickly and unpredictably. And one of the first ones that changed quickly and unpredictably was our school-based guidance, where we went from telling people to close schools to telling people to be more judicious in closing schools, and we did that in probably a matter of like 72 hours. But again, since our initial messages were letting people know that that was a possibility, when we made those changes, we were able to go back and tell them that. And then the other major component of our foundation is this one, which is know the intent of your messages and your communication strategies. I often, when we develop our communication strategies, we ask people, so what is the desired headline? If you were going to seek media attention on this, you know, what headline would appear tomorrow in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution? And you have to be able to think in terms of crystal clear outcomes with your communications. A simple example from one of our first press conferences that embodies much of that was this one of the quotes from Dr. Shuket on April 23rd, where we tell people that you can get swine flu without direct contact with swine, but it's unusual. We believe at this point human-to-human spread is occurring. That is unusual. We don't yet know how widely, so we're acknowledging uncertainty. We certainly don't know the extent of the problem, acknowledging uncertainty. But we also tell people what we're doing. We are taking active steps to learn more, and as we learn more, we will work to keep you updated. And so again, taking those components of risk communications and actually applying them in terms of the messages that we disseminate. Effective immunization communications, I think, has a lot of components on the media front. For H1N1, we had regular and frequent press briefings. We started daily and then moved to less than that. To make sure that a wide range of partners can actually hear what we're saying, we have a listen-only line for our press conferences, and we disseminate that number as broadly as people desire. And so very often we were having press conferences where there were 75 to 100 members of the media on the call, but when Dr. Frieden announced or was responding to the declaration of a pandemic, we had 2,500 other people listening in on the listen-only number. And we often had 1,300, 1,400, 1,500 people listening in on our press conferences live as they were taking place. And again, trying to expand the access. And then we did a lot of brief background briefings for the press, a lot of group briefings, bringing people to Atlanta, and then making sure our website was current and up to date. Multiple communications channels. And again, a lot of these things we used in the world of immunization communications. We used the news media, we used websites, we used public service announcements. We did probably more purchased media time than we would normally do with immunization, but we had a significant component there. We used a wide variety of social and new media, ranging from things that people are familiar with, podcasts, to things that we developed as a result of H1N1. And one of the things that we developed as a result of H1N1 was something called content syndication. And what content syndication enabled us to do was to have partners, state and local health departments, HHS, get content from CDC, put it on their website, and then if we updated that information on our website, it was automatically updated on their website without human intervention. And that was a major breakthrough, because a lot of people cut and paste information from CDC's website and put it on their website, which is a good thing, but if we change it and they don't go to our website for a week or two, or if they don't go to that particular page, they may never know that we updated or changed our content. And in the early days of H1N1, we were often changing content daily. And so what was up on Tuesday might not be the same thing that was up on Monday. And it would be increasingly frustrating for people to have to track all those changes. And so we worked really hard to develop this content syndication method, which was a technical application where if we knew people were using the content, we could get them into the system. And so when we updated it, it became updated on their site. And clearly, I think I'll talk to you about later on, that has implications moving forward for immunization communications, because it means that state and local health departments can access CDC information without having to worry about it becoming dated or out of date. We collaborated with a wide range of entities, and again, a lot of this was easy to do because we had a long history and tradition of doing this in the world of immunization communications. And so it wasn't new to me and it wasn't new to our office to be able to interact with other parts of HHS, but more importantly, interact with a wide range of partners, state and local health departments, the National Influenza Vaccine Summit, professional membership organizations, retailers, and pharmacies. And then along the way, we were constantly looking at a wide variety of data, some of it very empirical and highly quantitative, others parts of it more qualitative. But the idea was we were trying to monitor the environment to find out what the interests were, what the concerns were, what the questions were, what things we needed to do differently, what messages we needed to have that we currently didn't have. So with that as sort of the look in the rearview mirror, I think it's easier to kind of look forward. And I've now spun this girl around, just in case you haven't noticed. Before she was looking backwards, now she's looking forward. And look at what are the implications of all of this for future immunization-based communications. Well, I think one implication is that the most effective immunization communications is going to have certain characteristics. One is, going forward, we shouldn't lose sight of these key elements, that our most effective immunization communications, whether it's H1N1 related or related to some other vaccine-preventable disease, should have a strong foundation in risk communications principles and practice, audience research, and immunization communications best practices. That won't change. I don't think our need to be guided by surveys and other assessments will change. And so as we go forward and try to learn from this, I think what this experience of the last year has done is it reaffirms the importance of doing this. It also reaffirms the importance of using multiple communications channels and not relying solely on any single channel, including making more investments and more efforts to use some of the new in social media. Involving partners and collaborating with them extensively and coordinating our efforts with them, again, H1N1, I think, reaffirmed the importance and need of doing that. And I think as we go forward to the upcoming influenza season, I think you'll see this as being one of the strong foundations of CDC's efforts. And then with respect to the media, it all comes back to whether you have news and whether your news is something that meets the criteria that the news media have with respect to news. And so this one, rather than say you definitely have to have it or you definitely don't, it's more along the lines of depending on what your messages are and whether they meet the criteria of news, it potentially means having a comprehensive media relations and outreach plan. When it comes to upcoming influenza and influenza vaccine-related communications, I think there are a few things that we should prepare for in the coming months. One is that I think, based on my conversations with members of the media and our interactions over the last year, I would expect lots of interest and continued interest in the next few weeks and months about where things stand, such as, is this pandemic over? And if it's not over, where are we? And what does this transition look like? And where things are or where they may be going. And not just nationally. I mean, it's easy to get caught up in what the national picture is, but we talk to a lot of local reporters, and they're asking us, how do you think this is going to look in Kansas? How do you think this is going to look in New York City? And I'm sure you get more of those questions than we do. But I think being ready and prepared to answer those types of questions is a good idea. I think we should all anticipate that there will be much media, public, and parent interest in what this year's H1N1 vaccination means for vaccination in the coming season. With, you know, the obvious questions being, do I need to get vaccinated again? Or I got the H1N1 last year, do I need to get it again this year? Or if I got it in spring, do I need to get it in fall? Or do I need to get it in winter? So you'll get a lot of those types of questions. And we can plan for those now in terms of our communications plans. And we should start planning for those kinds of questions now. I think we'll also need to be ready to answer the, and why do I need to do that question? You know, if I got that vaccine then, why again? And there are good answers to those things, obviously, but getting ahead of the curve and thinking about those answers now would be a smart idea. I would anticipate that we will get much media, public, and parent interest in our predictions related to what's going to happen in the upcoming flu season, specifically, like, will it be a severe year? What strains will predominate? Will H1N1 cause most of the illness? If I had H1N1 last year, will I get sick with it again this year? As well as what our plans are and what our plans will be and how will they be different. And so we should be ready and prepared to begin answering those questions probably as soon as I think some of us are already getting some of those questions, we'll get a lot more of them. A third implication of H1N1 going forward is when it comes to the news media and all things influenza, it would be good to assume, again, strong interest in the transition from this flu season to the next. And again, if you're a reporter or you're a news media outlet, this is news. You haven't lived through a transition before, just like you haven't probably lived through a pandemic before. And so we experience a pandemic is new, a transition from a pandemic to seasonal flu is going to be novel for a while for the media. And so they will be very interested in that. They were going to be very interested, and again, because they often are anyway, in our forecasts in terms of severity, vaccine availability, how prevalent flu will be. Those questions will probably drive us crazy. But those are the kinds of questions they tend to ask, and they will tell you when you ask them that they ask those questions because A, their editors are telling them to ask them those questions, and B, people want to know so people can plan. And then they're also going to want to know things about spending and budgets, and will our efforts be bigger than or greater than or equal to last year, and all those sorts of things. And again, developing those messages now is a smart idea. I would think that if this begins to look more like seasonal flu or play out like a typical flu season, we will lose some of their interest in terms of intensity and duration, because the more it looks like something they've seen before, the less newsworthy it becomes. And so from that perspective, I would guess, or I would, you know, one possibility is that this will more closely resemble a usual flu season than that associated with a pandemic. And if that happens, we will probably see less news media interest or intensity and duration of interest. I think based on last year, I would expect more skepticism and questioning of forecasts and plans. And here the media play both sides of the fence. I mean, they will ask you for those forecasts and plans. And many people will say, well, why don't you just tell them you don't know? Well, about the 50th or 60th time that they ask you what is going to happen and you say you don't know, you begin to look like you're clueless. And so there is a strong desire to let them know that you do have a sense, albeit maybe not a strong one, but just saying don't know, doesn't often get conveyed real good through the media. And when they do ask those things, I think we should expect that there will be skepticism and questioning. How did you come up with that number? How certain are you with that number? Why that number and not some other number? And I think we also have taught them, all of us being local, state, and national, that they should be able to easily get regular and frequent updates on the things that they're interested in. And so I don't see us being able to go back in time and say, well, we just provide that information once a week or once a month. I think we've taught them that this information's on our websites and it's updated regularly, and I think the expectation will be that it will continue going forward. When it comes to the 2011 flu season and communications plans, I would suggest that, again, it's important to undertake audience research to guide those plans. It'll be very important to figure out and find out where people's belief systems are with respect to the upcoming flu season. And that'll be critically important information for developing messages and materials going forward. Probably this year more so than the past, because last year we had recommendations for two different influenza vaccines. And we had many guidelines. And so to find out where we have left people and where we have left our key populations when it comes to flu and flu vaccination will be critically important for developing communication strategies and messages in the upcoming season. We have learned, and we learned again through H1N1, that while we put people in groups and we say that these groups are at higher risk for complications from influenza and therefore should be among the first to get vaccinated against influenza, the people we put in those groups often don't see themselves as being high risk. And so if they have diabetes or they have a heart condition and it's under control, they feel like, I'm okay. And so these things may help us, but again, it's getting those people who we want to get the vaccine to take action, but we can't simply assume that because you have that condition, you will hear our recommendation and you will take our recommendation to heart. There will be a universal recommendation for the first time for influenza vaccination. Many people have said, if you had a universal recommendation, that will make life so much simpler. It'll be so easy to communicate that. Everybody get a flu shot. Everybody get a flu vaccination. Well, the challenge there is that it's not likely that one message is going to resonate across all those different audiences, from pregnant moms to seniors to parents of school-aged children. And so our need to figure out who the key audiences are, to design communication strategies and messages that are tailored to those different audiences doesn't go away. And I think if we think it goes away, we'll be in big trouble, because we'll probably see that many of those groups are going to see our messages not resonating with them. And so we can't be fooled by the fact that, yes, the vaccination is now recommended for everyone. That doesn't mean that one message is going to fit all, one communication strategy is going to fit all. In fact, it's probably not the case, and we need to continue to do the things that we've been doing on that front in terms of breaking the population into logical groups and designing messages for people in those groups. So if anything, it's going to increase the amount of communications and messages that will be needed to be successful. My plug for content syndication, since we do it at CDC, I told my e-health people I would plug content syndication. If you're interested in content syndication, contact us and let us know. And that's something that can be planned for and done before the upcoming flu season. And then having realistic expectations. And this is sort of modified from a message I was giving early on last year, is when it comes to things like influenza immunization, it's very important to recognize that there's a difference between demand or consumer demand for the option of having vaccine there and available if I want it, and actually behaving and getting that vaccination. And typically what happens is the demand for choice exceeds the demand for actual behavior, the number of people who actually do the behavior. Many more people want the option. And so if you have a limited number of doses, you shouldn't be surprised that twice as many people may want it. And then when you have lots of doses and not all those people step forward and get it, that's one of the reasons why. They weren't necessarily going to get it. They just wanted the ability to say no. And if they didn't have that ability, they felt like you had taken it away from them. And so that's often a factor. And again, with a new recommendation, there will not be, I don't think, 300 million doses of flu vaccine available come fall for all 300 million Americans who may want to step forward and get it. When it comes to other immunization recommendations in our communications, I think what I would take away is a few things. One is that this is a reminder that outbreaks do get news coverage, or they can generate media attention and public awareness of vaccine-preventable diseases and vaccine recommendations. We saw a tremendous amount of media coverage, almost nonstop for about 4 or 5 months, and even after that, for many of the months that followed, lots of attention. But if the idea is that you're going to be outbreak-based and you're going to use outbreaks as the primary stepping stone for your communications, I would also note that this also illustrates the high bar that must be met if you hope to achieve sustained, broad, visible media coverage. You have to have new developments on a daily or weekly basis. You have to be impacting a large number of people, and it's really a high bar to hit in terms of sustaining that kind of media coverage, and it's atypical, not typical. Will H1N1 have a lasting effect in terms of how people view flu shots or flu vaccination and other vaccinations? I think to some extent, yes. It provides a teachable moment in the importance of vaccination as a way of preventing or protecting someone from a disease. But I think we'll also find that for many people, that impact is fleeting. And when something else takes their attention, they will forget about that. And it also doesn't reduce or take away the need to do all those other communications efforts. When it comes to communications related to future pandemics, things that I think we can take away from the past year are: practice is important. Those tabletops, those exercises that we did, although they had shortcomings and omissions, things that they weren't intentional. We now know what those are. Now that we know what those are, we can build them in. And so as we go forward on the tabletop and drill front, we ought to look at what happened in this past year and build in some of the things that were missing from those exercises before, because they couldn't have been imagined or they weren't envisioned. And then I think the other thing I think is an urgent need when it comes to future pandemics is thinking now about what we would do and how we would talk about new vaccines and new vaccine formulations. I think Dr. Frieden mentioned this on many occasions, that if we had had cell-based influenza vaccines, would people have been willing to accept them during a pandemic if that was the first time that we brought these things out? And I think right now is the time, but before the next pandemic, to do the communications research and to start thinking about the messaging and how we can get people comfortable with things that are otherwise going to be novel and new without making them fearful of them. And that's always a difficult challenge, but it's much more difficult if you have to do it in the moment versus before the moment. Now, Elizabeth Cohen was going to be here. And since she's not, I thought I took the liberty to what might the media say if the media were present. I told Chris the first thing I'd say that the media would say was we did a marvelous job. We nailed everything, hit it all on the head. But this is not Elizabeth. This is just and these come from things that I have heard the media say to me in the past few months and then over the course of the past year. I do think many of them would say that much was done right and well in terms of providing the news media information and access. And we did work on many fronts. You did, I did, the department did, in terms of trying to meet the demands of the news media in terms of information and resources, answering their questions promptly. A wide variety of experts, not just at the CDC, we directed media to answer questions, and those people took time out and did a terrific job. And I think the media, for the large part, would say that we did a pretty good job, probably one of the better jobs ever done. I think it would also tell us that, you know, our terms, our definitions and assumptions aren't often clear, and it would be helpful if they were clearer. And that includes things like pandemic. What is a pandemic? Is it novelty or severity that matters most when it comes to actions and taking actions? What's the reason for your, or the basis for your recommendations? Because often we assume that they know. We assume they must have been at that ACIP meeting. I was there. Certainly they should have been there. I should have read about it on the Associated Press wire. And the rationale was clearly made plain. It's on the website in the MMWR. But many of the reporters we deal with don't have the ability or luxury of being able to go and track that stuff down. And so when we interact with them, we have to make it clear. And that's often easy to overlook. I think you would hear the media say, because they've been saying this to me over the past 12 months, that we want and need better estimates, forecasts, and predictions. Wouldn't we all like to have better estimates, forecasts, and predictions? It kind of goes without saying. They not only want them, but they would also like if we would just go down a couple of notches and make those available at the community level and the state level as well. And so, again, the media are driven by their audience interests, and a lot of the public is interested in those things. Now, clearly, for many of these things, all we have is estimates, and all we have is our judgment, in many cases, in terms of making predictions. And so we go there with much caution. But understand that the media thinks that because we're scientists or we're science-based organizations and we count things, that we have a great deal of precision when it comes to these things. And so we can tell them, as of last week, X number of people got an influenza immunization, X number of people got the flu. They expect that all those things are countable and are counted and are surprised otherwise. And I think as we move forward in our communications planning, we need to factor that in, the fact that we need to do some education before the flu season as to what is countable and counted and why certain things can't or aren't. I think they would tell us, because they have told me, that we can expect that when it comes to providing visibility of recommendations and efforts and the value of vaccination, they're willing to do that when the flu season is kicked off and when we kick off the influenza vaccination season. They have typically a lot of interest because at that point it makes sense in terms of how their media operations run. But after that, unless we have news, it goes right back to, you know, we're interested in what you have as long as it's news. And if you have news, we're interested in covering it. If you don't, we're not your publicity agent. And, you know, much as you would like us to be, we in the news media are not your partner. If you want to find a partner, it's a different part of the media. It's the sales reps who will sell you the time and the air and other things. That those are the places where most partnerships are built. And I think it's important to always remember that. And related to that, we did press conferences on a regular basis for a number of months, and there were a few times where we questioned why we were holding a press conference, because it wasn't clear to us what our desired headline was or what the news was that day. And we often paid for it because they showed up at the anointed hour and they expected news. And if we didn't have news, they were going to ask questions such as, so what's the news? What's the purpose of this press conference? And we also, in a couple of press conferences, got in trouble because what happened was, without a strong hook and a strong focus, they delved into the what-if questions. You know, so what if, you know, this happened? And I think one of those press conferences, somebody got that question, I think it was one of our scientists, and it was asked, well, what if you're ready to be able to do seasonal flu vaccination campaign early in August, would you do it? And he answered, well, if that was possible, we might do it. Which led to headlines, CDC will launch, you know, seasonal flu campaign in August. And then we had to go call the media up and say, no, we never said that. It was a what if question, and we said, what if, and if the world looked like that and this. But all those caveats get lost. And so it's really important when you call the media to the table that you understand why you're calling them, you have a good sense of what your desired outcome is. And so those, I think, are things that the media might say. And with that, I thank you.